Hello there. You're listening to the Box Office Show. I'm Ryan Hill.
And I'm Dylan Johnson. Today we're going to be talking about the box office numbers from last weekend and our box office predictions for this upcoming weekend.
We'll also discuss the 2024 CinemaCon presentations, and then we'll give our review of the latest discourse-heavy Alex Garland film, Civil War. Before we hop into all this CinemaCon discussion, first we got to talk about Tarantino and his famed 10th and final film. It is no longer going to be The Movie Critic. So he's back to square one of figuring out what his 10th film is going to be.
That's so sad. I was looking forward to it. It sounded, I mean, we knew nothing about it, but it seemed like it would be cool. It was going to be a throwback to like the late 60s, early 70s, much like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was. It had Brad Pitt returning as Cliff Booth, which was funny. I thought, you know, it's sad, especially because now we'll never see it ever made ever. He'll probably release it, I'm sure, as like a book, because that's what he did with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. He writes all his movies as books first and then turns them into scripts. And so Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is a book that you can buy. And I'm sure The Movie Critic will probably come out as a book that you can buy. But now he's got to, I think he just needs, it's hard. It's hard to know that this is going to be your last movie of all time. And so you have to really, really be sure about what you're making. And right. I've always liked that Tarantino has stuck to his guns about only making 10 movies. I think that's gutsy. I think it's cool. I think I agree with him when he says that as the years go on, a lot of filmmakers start to wither away into the ether. Most of them do. There are only a few standouts that will stay strong, like Scorsese or Spielberg. Most of the time, they're no longer like event films that people go and see. Even, you know, nowadays, a Scorsese film isn't as much of an event film as it was in the late 90s, early 2000s, but still, people will still pull up because he's like the apex of filmmaking. So I agree with Tarantino in the idea that he wants to end his movies while they're still event films, that people will want to go see a Tarantino movie, as opposed to like 20, 30 years from now when he's an old, old, old man making a movie and only the film nerds are like, hey, that Tarantino guy just made a movie. Let's go see it. And so only the film nerds go and see it, or only the diehard fans go and see it. He wants everybody to come out and see a Tarantino movie because it's still a Tarantino movie. And I respect that. I think that's awesome. So, I mean, if he needs to take his time and he needs to be 100% positive that this is the movie he wants to make, take your time. Find the right story. Tell the right story because it's the last chance he's got.
Right. I think him needing to feel confident and fully assured about whatever this next film is going to be is an interesting aspect to it. Mm-hmm. I am sad, though, that he's put that constraint on him. And now it does seem, I mean, I guess we don't know exactly what the concerns are with the production and why he's, you know, moving on from this one as his final mm-hmm. film. But it's just sad that think of all the films that we could get from him that we never will because he's putting this 10 film limit on him. I mean, look at some of the stuff Scorsese's done in the past 10 years.
Yeah.
And that man's 80 years old. And Spielberg as well, having like a late stage renaissance with his films. I mean, I know you weren't the biggest fan of Fablemans, but it was in your like top 10 or your honorable mentions or something like that. So it's still
up there, yeah.
Yeah, high caliber, high quality work that they're pumping out in their 70s and 80s. So I think we have, I mean, based on that stuff, at least 2 decades left that we could be getting Tarantino bangers. But I do respect that he's like, okay, I'm going to have a certain curated filmography. We'll do 10 and then we'll move on. But I don't know, his reasoning for that of like, oh, so many filmmakers sort of just lose their vision or their creativity as they get older. I think it's been disproven pretty heavily by some of our clear masters being able to put out at the least interesting and worthwhile films and at their best, like masterpieces. So I think it's a shame that we won't see more than just 10 films from Tarantino. I know he has a lot more to offer than that. So I'm sad The Movie Critic won't be a film that we ever get to see from him. But that does make me more curious about this next one. He just ramped up the pressure on him, though. Yeah. Imagine that, of like you've now like the canned
movie
this film.
Like everything we've heard about The Movie Critic, and it's still not good enough, and now we have to make something even better. when it sounded like it would be a very, very good and interesting movie. And now he's really stepping up his game because he wants it to be as good as possible. Like always, all of his movies are as good as possible. And this is the last one, so it has to be a strong finish.
Mm-hmm. So we will see. We'll see what his choice is for the final film and whether he'll be able to follow through with it. But that means we won't be seeing a Tarantino at least until 2026, maybe later. So a shame there. But let's talk about some of the movies that will be coming out over the next year. CinemaCon, of course, the annual get-together conference of all the theater owners and then the studios that go. It's all taking place in Las Vegas. It's a week long, and they present footage, trailers, sneak peeks, big discussions with the cast and crew and the directors for all the films coming up in the next year that they're trying to hype up the theater owners about so that they'll provide a whole lot of auditoriums for that film and that hopefully it'll be, you know, one of the big successes over the next year for both the studios and the theaters themselves. So we always get to hear a lot of new things or, you know, the sneak peeks again before they go wide to the general public. We get to hear a lot of what the studios are cooking up in these presentations. So we'll cover some of the more flashier or well-known things. They do talk a lot about all the films coming out basically in their next year. So there's a lot of these smaller films that we're not going to touch on so much just out of time. And because we aren't the ones able to go to CinemaCon, if we could, that'd be awesome. And we could maybe talk one through day. Every single film. Yeah, maybe one day. But for now, we have to get like these secondhand reports. Obviously, no footage is allowed in there. So it's just hearing what people have said and what the late consensus is of the reporters and whatnot who were able to go to that. So again, we'll stick with the bigger event films and just talk about what we've learned from those. We'll start out with Warner Brothers, and we can talk about this particular film because it dropped a trailer a week or two ago for everyone to see. Joker 2, Joker Folie à Deux. They dropped the trailer. We've finally gotten the glimpse of Joaquin Phoenix reprising his role and Lady Gaga coming in as Harley Quinn. Dylan, it's no secret that we were both not the biggest fans of the first Joker.
But I would argue I was the worst fan of the smallest fan of the Joker. I really, really did not like that movie. The only saving grace of it was the technicals, you know, how it looked, how it felt. All of that was done well. But just the story to me was so abysmal and so poorly written that I was very, very saddened and upset and disappointed in a lot of ways.
Right. So for Joker 2, seeing that trailer, what are your thoughts on it?
They got me again. What can I say? I mean, the first Joker trailer, it got me. It made me really excited for the movie, and then I was disappointed. And they did it again. Now I'm really excited for Joker Folie à Deux, even though there's a good chance that I will be just as disappointed. It's the same people working on the project. There's no new names, really. So, I mean, the technicals, I'm sure, will be as superb as they were in the first movie, of course.
It seems like it, based on that trailer.
Yeah,
it
but, looks I mean, great. There's still a decent chance I won't like it in the same way I didn't like the first Joker. So, I mean, we'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah, I think as you said, all the technicals there were great, and it seems like that is going to carry over to Joker 2. Has, again, the same visual style, looks fantastic. The music was such a prominent part of the first one, and now obviously it's going to take even more of the center stage in the second one. So I'm curious to see how that exactly plays out. They did have Todd Phillips there on stage, and they were talking about whether or not it was a musical, and he said it wasn't a musical, but it has a lot of musical elements to it. They also said that it wouldn't be entirely like original music or songs that they'd be doing. It might be,
yeah, they'd be singing like hit songs.
Existing songs. Yeah. So
that's what I understood about it. Yeah.
That's an interesting choice there.
I could be down.
But again, I'm for it. I think it's what an amazing turn to take to make it more musical. Bringing in Lady Gaga.
Yeah. The question is, can Joaquin Phoenix hold his own against Lady Gaga singing? I don't think so.
I mean, You know, you don't need to. We had Bradley Cooper for A Star Is Born, and he did well enough. But that whole point was like, oh,
I thought he was good.
Like, Lady Gaga's such a star, especially musically. So I think in this one, they might play around with that. But yeah, I don't think we need Joaquin Phoenix to be matching Lady Gaga's pipes. But yeah, I think it'll be certainly an interesting film, no matter what. I'm excited to see it and talk about it. We'll definitely devote a show to it. But yeah, I think from what I saw, again, we can't, because the very first Joker trailer for that first film was also amazing and got me hyped up for it. This one, I'm going to temper my expectations, but I am intrigued.
I can't help it. It just looked really good. I'm very excited.
They really did.
Also, it's a box office draft, so everybody should go watch Joker 2, regardless of whether you like the first one or not.
Rated R for sure.
Of course.
But with a much bigger budget, so we'll see about the profitability. But yeah, it could. It's the first one was a $1 billion film. We'll see what this one does. But yeah, moving on to Mickey 17. They showed a trailer at CinemaCon. We have still not seen a trailer. The general public, we have not been able to
see it. I saw them announce it, and I'm checking every day waiting for it to drop, and it's not coming out. And I'm so mad that I got to push to 2025. I'm so mad.
Yeah, it's absurd. And they've said
it was my number one anticipated movie this year.
It was number one. They said the film is done. It's ready to go. It's been ready to go for months, and yet it's not coming out till January 2025, I believe.
It's no fair that you get Megalopolis and I don't get Mickey 17. I think that's unfair. I think Francis Ford Coppola should push it.
We'll see if we get Megalopolis. If you've heard from the screenings, some studios are a little hesitant on picking it up for distribution.
Really?
So, yeah.
Uh-oh.
So it may or may not. He might have to do it himself. He's trying to get it to premiere at the Cannes Film Festival. But yeah, we will see if it does go wide or not. At least this year. But hey, I'm still rooting for my man. It could be a misunderstood masterpiece. You never know. But it at least sounds like from the trailer that Mickey 17 is not going to be misunderstood at all. It is going to be a great film with Robert Pattinson going wild in it. We got a taste of that in Boy and the Heron, but this dude apparently goes all out with his accents. I guess in The Lighthouse too, is he putting on some wild accents and stuff?
No, that's
like that.
How he actually talks in real life.
Okay. I haven't seen The Lighthouse. I don't know what his actual voice is in there. So if he does speak crazy, and you just said that,
you've never seen The Lighthouse?
No.
You never saw the scene where he goes, "If I had a steak, I'd fuck it"?
No.
Oh man, you're missing out.
I'll see it sometime soon. I'm sure
it's really
when
good.
Nosferatu comes around, we'll have to do a.
It's Eggers Robert episode. Eggers' masterpiece is The Lighthouse. Yeah.
So I've heard. But moving on from that, we can talk about Jack Black having a career renaissance here with voice acting, at least. Although I think this Minecraft film is live action, so that's what's weird about it. But he is, in fact, Steve in Minecraft.
And it's live action? How? How do you make a live action Minecraft? Just make it animated. How? How do you do that? How?
I have no clue. I don't know. Honestly, there's not confirmation on that, but apparently they didn't show footage or anything. It was a video from Jack Black, essentially vlogging like on set, just showing things around. And apparently there were a lot of, you know, blocky production items there.
What the
so,
fuck?
Yeah, we'll see how that turns out. But terrible. Honestly, anything Jack Black is doing lately, I feel like it's worthwhile. I feel like it'll be fun, or at least he in it will be.
Jack Black has always been the greatest. He's one of my heroes, 100%. But live action Minecraft, come on. It can't be good.
There were also some set photos from Superman, which of course is in the midst of filming. There was nothing to show footage-wise. They're not going to put dailies up on the screen there. So next year, I'm sure it'll be a much bigger part of Warner Brothers' presentation. Mm-hmm. But it is happening. James Gunn is his big make-or-break film.
Yeah, I saw a video he posted somewhere in Norway or something like that. Filming somewhere where it's big snow-capped mountains and whatnot. That I'm assuming is where the Fortress of Solitude is going to be. Mm-hmm. And it looked very pretty. It looked like a very good set choice or a location choice.
Yeah, we didn't get a sneak peek at the suit, but they have dropped the logo. Have you seen that?
I have not.
Like the logo of it, it's definitely the old-fashioned logo, like his original sort of S, where it doesn't look too much like an S. So, interesting choice. It may just be like that initial suit, and then they might change it later on to make it a bit more recognizable. But yeah, I was hoping they were going to drop the suit, but they did not.
No, it's too far out.
And another notable piece of the Warner Brothers presentation, which thankfully we were also able to get a glimpse of because they released the trailer, M. Night Shyamalan's newest film, Trap, which you just watched the trailer for before we hopped on the recording. So Dylan, your thoughts?
I liked it. I think it looks cool. It's a very, very interesting premise. I won't spoil anything because, oddly enough, you know, M. Night Shyamalan's plot twist. He puts a plot twist in the trailer, which I think is very funny. Mm-hmm. So go watch the trailer. Get your own impression of it. But I enjoyed the trailer. I think it looks good. I think it's a very, very strong concept for a movie. I could see where it could go off the rails and be something that I don't like in an M. Night Shyamalan sort of way. But I also could see potential for something that's at the very least interesting and exciting. So I'm probably going to watch it. I think it sounds cool. Unless the reviews are absolutely abysmal, then I might skip it. But I think it'll be good.
Yeah, he always comes out with great concepts. There's a great premise to this one too, which again, I'm sure that's just a setup to the movie, but it is a nice trailer to see him build something up and then immediately throw a reversal in there. Mm-hmm. So people should check out that trailer just to see what the concept is, but I'm sure it has even more twists and turns planned for that story. But I think as long as, again, the reviews aren't abysmal, it might be one that I check out. I kind of meant to do that with the last film too. I think I said that, like A Knock at the Cabin. That was also an interesting premise. I never ended up checking that one out.
We will see if he's able to
pull me into the theaters for it. But it does. This
is the first one I got pulled into since Split, I think. Split was the last one that I saw that I was like, ooh, that looks really good. I think I'm going to check it out. And then I did, and I liked it. So Trap could have that.
The last one I saw.
And this might have the potential to bring me back to the theaters. You know, Old did not seem that interesting. A Knock at the Cabin didn't seem that interesting. The Servant, his show on Apple TV, kind of seems interesting, and I'm willing to check it out. I just don't have Apple TV, and I'm not willing to pay for it. Because Apple TV has so few shows that I like. I don't really care about watching the rest of the morning show. I want to see the last season of Ted Lasso. I think I'll wait for season two of Severance to come out so that I can watch that and also the last season of Ted Lasso and then probably Servant, and then I'll just cancel it again because there's just not enough content that I think is enjoyable on Apple TV Plus for me to pay for it every month.
Yeah.
You need to watch some of those shows, though. I told you would like Severance a lot.
Yeah. It's very whenever good. It comes back around, I'll try and hop on there for the Apple TV.
And then you can watch Ted Lasso at the same time.
Are compelling. Like For All Mankind does seem interesting.
Oh, sure.
Foundation also seems interesting. They do have some notable shows, but they're just not talked about a lot. Except, I guess, Ted Lasso and then Severance. Those were the ones that were breakouts. But yeah, they do seem to be producing a lot of high quality shows. But
Severance was surprising.
Need to get more in the conversation. But all right, let's talk about Lionsgate and their presentation and Margot Robbie's monopoly on advertisement films. She did Barbie, conquered the world with it. She's doing The Sims, and now she's doing Monopoly.
That's crazy. Talk about a game that defined my childhood. No board game defined my childhood more than Monopoly.
Why did it define your childhood?
Dude, we played Monopoly all the time in my house, and the fights that we had. I remember going to my grandma's house and playing Monopoly when I was like 5 or 6. And my mom asking my grandma, you know, can you go easy on him? You know, he's 5. Can you just like go a little easy? And my grandma going, no, that's cheating. It's Monopoly. I have to play as good as I can. So I was going against this grown woman who has spent her whole life working on investments and like investing her money and understanding how actual monopolies work. And being ruthless while she plays this game. So I'm used to a very ruthless version of Monopoly.
That's awesome. Your grandma and I would be friends. For sure.
Absolutely.
Nice. I mean, yeah, it was definitely, it is a staple. I feel like every single household has at least one Monopoly version in their house. Mm-hmm. We had like the online banking version, like the, where they would have the credit card thing.
Oh, I had that.
The actual little tally thing. Yeah, that was always fun to do it.
The digitally. Little credit cards, yeah. I had that. Mm-hmm. I had the original. I had the Gators, like the UF Gators themed Monopoly. Because they'll theme Monopoly to fucking anything.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there's probably a UCF Knights Monopoly, I'm sure.
I bet.
This Monopoly's right. God, I haven't played Monopoly in so long. We should play Monopoly, Ryan.
That'll be fun. We should bring it back. I think it's fun though when you theme it yourself as well. Like we go in there, like we did that one time. Just take on a persona, get in there.
Oh yeah, we did Wild West Monopoly.
Exactly. So yeah, you're not facing against Dylan Johnson. You're facing off against Ringo Bobby, or that Dylan the Kid. Is that your Wild West name? Nice. So yeah, we should do it sometime soon. But it'll be funny to see how they approach Monopoly. Again, she's not going to be in it. I think she's just producing it. So as a producer, she's just taking up all these brands, toys, anything she can get her hands on since the Barbie success was massive. So we'll see how all these other ones follow through. But yeah, that was announced. Naruto live action. I think we may have mentioned this one time before, but that is in the works at Lionsgate. And Destin Daniel Cretton from Shang-Chi is going to be directing that one. So as far as like the whole martial arts aspect, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'll be, again, we're in the boom period for live action adaptations of anime stuff. So this one, instead of going the Netflix series route, is going to the big screen, which I'm a fan of. I like having the big theatrical experiences for massive properties like this. We'll see how it goes, though. It's also one of those that I'm like, I don't know how you're going to be able to carry through with the whole story, but I guess they would like to do it since there's so much material. But we'll see how that shakes out. John Wick presents Ballerina. So they've changed the name on that. Instead of just calling it Ballerina, they want to make sure you know it's part of the John Wick universe. They showed the trailer there. Has not been released yet because Ballerina has been delayed a year. No. It's supposed to come out this summer. But
no,
we did get confirmation Keanu Reeves will be in it.
Yes.
Reprising his role as John Wick. It'll be taking place between John Wick 3 and John Wick 4.
Awesome.
But yeah, there we go.
I love John Wick. I really hope they make a John Wick 5. I know he's dead, but I really hope they make a John Wick 5. I mean, he just died so prematurely in John Wick 4. He's got to come back. He didn't defeat the High Table. The High Table still exists. He has to take down the High Table, Ryan.
I hear you.
The Marquee was not enough. He needs to take down
the High Table. I hear you. They'll probably do it. I mean, they made so much money. I don't know why they did the whole death fake out stuff, but yeah, we'll see. They'll probably, I mean, when they have this one, they're going to feature John Wick so heavily in it anyway. It might as well be like a new John Wick film. So they'll probably go ahead and do another one. The Borderlands trailer, again, talking about like the video game movies and TV show adaptations. We just had Fallout. Yeah. Amazon Prime, that's been doing
well. I started watching Fallout. I watched the first episode. It's really good.
Wow, that's crazy that you,
it's really
number one,
good.
Sought it out and watched it. Were you like a Fallout player?
My brother was. My brother was huge into Fallout. I was always the Skyrim guy. And then I would try Fallout, and I just didn't like the game mechanics as much as Skyrim, so I never played it that much. But I played the, you know, the app, the Fallout Shelter app.
I do remember.
I played that. That was a big thing in high school. And I just like the aesthetic of Fallout. I always have. I like the story of Fallout. I think it's really cool. I just could never get into the actual game mechanics themselves to get that far into the game. I always found it very difficult to get over the hump of I am starting each game as somebody who has no skill set and no equipment and whatsoever, and I have to do these missions and gain those things. I feel like it was a lot harder to get over that hump in Fallout than it was in Skyrim, which I think as an older person now, I probably could play Fallout and get more into it. I just don't really play video games that much anymore. But yeah, I watched the show. It's Jonathan Nolan, so I wanted to see it because I love Westworld. And it's really good. I mean, I've only seen the first episode, but it looks incredible. Like, visually, it is stunning. Nice. It's so much practical stuff. I'm like surprised, and it came out really, really good. And the stories are very well done.
That's good to hear. I've been hearing a lot of good things from people that have seen the whole series. So yeah, it's yet another success. I think it just got renewed for season two because it's been good. Extremely popular. So at least as far as TV goes, we know that the video game curse is over. And then also as far as movies, I don't know quality wise if that streak is over, but as far as box office success, Mario,
oh my god,
end of the streak. You have Sonic is doing really well for itself too. But Borderlands, that adaptation, I don't know how it'll go. I mean, I never played it. Did you play that?
I played Borderlands a little bit, yeah.
Okay. It seems like it'll not be great, but it does seem like it'll be kind of fun. So
it would be 100% fun, and it's definitely the kind of game that would make for a very interesting movie that could pull at the box office. So I understand the decision to want to make Borderlands a movie, and I think it's a strong choice, and I think it will do very, very well box office-wise, even if it isn't actually that good.
Right.
It's just such a unique and interesting concept. And there's just so many bonkers, funny things in the game that I think people will be excited to...
Claptrap. Jack Black is Claptrap. So that's just... Again, he's killing
strong choice, actually. That's he's a very strong choice.
Yeah.
I mean, I would have liked to see the original guy who voiced Claptrap come back just because Claptrap has such an iconic voice. But Jack Black is a very solid second choice.
Mm-hmm. So that one will be coming out later this year. We'll see how that goes financially and then the critical response. And then the final one from Lionsgate, I'll shout out The Killer's Game from Batista. Dave Batista, he's a hitman with a tumor. And he has only a few months to live, but he doesn't want to just deteriorate. So he decides to put a hit out on himself so he can go out in an exciting fashion. But then he gets a call from the doctor's office and they say, oh no, we mixed up the test results. You got the wrong diagnosis. You're not going to die. You don't have a tumor. But yet the hit is already out.
That's so a really
Batista
funny concept.
Has to fend off all the assassins coming after him. I thought so too. I was like, that's a fun, goofy premise. And I didn't see the actual trailer, so I don't know what exactly the tone is, but I'm assuming they're going for that sort of like, oh, this is just your worst possible day over and over again. So yeah, looking forward to that one. Let's go on to Universal. They had a lot of announcements, even though we knew all these things already. Mario 2, Five Nights at Freddy's 2, and Megan 2 have all been officially announced. Literally, I think Megan 2 was announced like January of last year when the first one came out. But regardless, they confirmed that those are in the works. Conclave was an interesting one that stuck out to me. It's all about the process, the secretive process that goes down when a pope dies or retires, and then they have to select a new pope and all the politicking that goes into that. Ray Fiennes is in it. Stanley Tucci, John Lithgow. Talk about a cast right there.
Hell yeah.
And then it's from the director of All Quiet on the Western Front.
Oh, okay.
So this one definitely piqued my interest when I was scrolling through, so I'm giving that a shout out here. Nosferatu. Woo! From Robert Eggers. So yeah, you and all the big Eggerheads out there. You can
say that.
Rejoice.
Hang on now, pause.
I know, I need to see The Lighthouse first, and then I can say that.
You shouldn't say that regardless. It does not sound good.
So, yeah, Nosferatu this year. Coming out December, so a fun Christmas movie. And then they also talked about Despicable Me 4. We've seen the trailer for that already. Twisters, seen the trailer for that. And then Wicked, we've seen some footage. They brought out Ariana Grande and the rest of the cast for that and showed a bit more footage. I'm going to be really curious to see. You have to go see it. I think just
I will
you
go
being
it.
A big Wicked fan. I mean, you have to. And then we need
I will
to
go see it. And I'll be disappointed.
Your thoughts. Yeah, if you're disappointed, you hate on it.
I'm sure the singing will be fantastic, which is what a lot of people go to Wicked to see. You know, it's a musical. And I'm sure, I mean, Cynthia Erivo and Ariana Grande, their singing is going to be incredible. But as a movie, I just don't think it's going to be that good. That's right. That's my prediction. But I think the singing will be fantastic, of course. Now, Twisters, I'm really... Dude, watching Civil War in theaters and seeing the Twisters trailer on the big screen, it looks so good.
It does, dude.
It reminds me of, like...
is a star.
Oh, my God. He's so cool. And it reminds me of the actual like 90s sort of action movies that were a little bit odd and weird, like the original Twister. It reminded mm-hmm. me of those kinds of movies. And it's just like, oh God, it looks so good. I'm very excited for Twisters. Lee Isaac Chung, you've done it again. You brilliant bastard.
For real. Yeah, I'm definitely excited for that one. It's like the perfect summer blockbuster coming out. Can't wait for that one.
I'm very excited. It's going to be awesome.
Paramount had quite a few things in their lineup. First off, they made the official announcement that there will be a Transformers G.I. Joe crossover.
Live action?
Yes.
That's awesome.
Isn't it? That's hilarious.
That's so cool.
You never saw the newest Transformers, did you?
No, I've only seen the first Transformers.
And then, because it was a solo show, I think. So you didn't hear like what happened there. But when I went and saw it and then reviewed on the show, I talked about the end credit scene is Anthony Ramos in some government facility. And then he's talking to the dude and he's like, yeah, just keep that on the low. But also, by the way, if you ever wanted to use those skills for something else, give us a call. And then he leaves, does something so that, you know, the bookshelves and all this in the room start folding away. And it reveals this massive warehouse. And then you see the G.I. Joe like logo or whatever their organization exactly is. And then so that was the teaser, is that the G.I. Joe awesome. World is now in the Transformers world. And so we were waiting to see, because the box office success wasn't the best for that latest film. Mm-hmm. We didn't know if they were going to pull the trigger on it, but they are. They're doing the crossover for it.
Dude, that's
amazing. That's so silly and stupid, but
I'm say go for
there
it.
For it. That's what crazy. I said too in the room. I'm like, that's ridiculous. Do it now. Do it now. And they did it. So we're going to get that. Also, Sonic 3, Jim Carrey is in fact returning.
That's crazy.
It's great. Coming out of retirement
again for Sonic.
I mean,
his story must be told.
Yeah, when you have a cinematic masterpiece, you need to follow through. You can't leave that hanging. And then Shadow is allegedly, I still don't think we have actual confirmation on this because they didn't reveal it at the CinemaCon mm-hmm. presentation. But since then, there's been some reports about it. It looks like it'll be Keanu Reeves who will be voicing Shadow. So we'll have to see about that. But I mean, I think that works. Some other things here, Naked Gun, Scary Movie reboots.
Not a fan.
Bring back the parody, I guess.
Not a fan. You just can't do it better than the original Naked Gun. Like, you can't. Who's going to replace Leslie Nielsen? Nobody. Nobody could replace him. He's too fucking good.
Yeah. I mean,
who's going to replace O.J. Simpson?
Okay. Yeah. So we'll see how those go. But yeah, those don't really interest me as much. Again, that'll have to be dependent on when we see the trailer. It seems like they capture some magic there.
Dude, I love the original Naked Gun. It's so funny.
Mm-hmm. And then Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. We are getting a Last Ronin adaptation, R-rated live action. Do you know about The Last Ronin, what the story is?
Isn't that a movie with no, that's The Last Samurai. I was going to make a Tom Cruise joke. Never mind.
Yeah, no Tom Cruise involved, so that'd be hilarious if they did.
He plays Raphael. He's just in a giant turtle costume.
No more Taka Maverick, no more Mission Impossible. I need to go finish my career as a turtle. But it's the story where it's like three of the brothers are dead. And then there's one remaining, and he's trying to get revenge. And it's like gruesome and bloody and R-rated and all that. And you don't know which brother is alive as you're following him through it, which is pretty interesting. But yeah, they're going for this, apparently. R-rated and live action, which seems crazy to me, especially since they just had that other one last year, The Mutant Mayhem. And they're going to continue with that one. So I feel like it'll be strange to have both those going on. But
nah, I think it'll be cool. It's like having multiple Batman movies coming out all at the same time, you know? Just try and do things with the same character. What do I
We'll
care?
See how that goes, if it can be sustained. But I mean, think it's a cool idea to do at some point. I just wish they'd give that other one some room to breathe.
I think it's okay to have two different Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles stories happening simultaneously, especially since one is live action, one is animated. I think there's a very clear distinction between the two. And it's just different versions of these characters, which I think is fine. I'm excited. Yeah. It sounds cool. I mean, I'm down to watch a turtle fuck some people up.
It is a cool
in the same way that I'm excited to watch a couple of kid turtles have a blast in an animated world.
Mm-hmm. Fair. I mean, I'll be down for it. I'll go see it, of course. And then Transformers 1. So another Transformers film, this one being the animated one, the origin story taking place on Cybertron. We got Hemsworth as Optimus Prime, Brian Tyree Henry as Megatron, Scarlett Johansson as one of them. And then Keegan-Michael Key as Bumblebee. So the trailer for this one dropped.
God.
It was a long trailer. And it was not a good trailer.
So
I didn't encourage you to watch it at all beforehand. We'll see how it goes. But I don't know. The tone was sort of all over the place. The animation style also. Just because we're living in the world now of like Spider-Verse and Puss in Boots and all that. This one definitely felt subpar compared to that.
That's crazy because it's the guy who directed Toy Story 4.
Yeah.
That's sad.
Which was phenomenal. But again, that's just from the trailer. Sometimes you can be surprised by how much better the film is rather than the trailer. But yeah, I was on the fence about it beforehand, and it took me off the fence and into the I will not go see it category. So not really what you want to do with a trailer. And then Aang. The Last Airbender, that'll be the film, the animated Avatar film with them being adults, I believe is the whole premise of that. That'll be coming out in January 2026, so that's been delayed a bit, and nothing was shown about it, no footage or anything like that, which is a little troubling, but yeah, that'll be the official title, Aang, The
Last Airbender. That's so far from now, though, 2026.
It is very far. 2 years. That's rough.
What a long wait. Of course, when I wake up tomorrow, I've completely forgotten that we talked about it until someone brings it up again. So I am counting on my bad memory to carry me through the pain of not seeing it so far.
Nice. And then we had Disney. So,
boo.
Boo, wow.
Not a big Disney guy anymore. They're Bob going Iger
getting,
downhill.
Getting wrecked.
I mean, I appreciate Bob Iger as a CEO in terms of willing to spend money to make money compared to whoever the last Bob was. I forget his name.
Bob Chapek.
Yeah. Bob Iger, I think, is a much more adventurous and willing to go there sort of CEO than Bob Chapek. But I still have disdain for Disney as a corporation and Disney as a money-making entity. Especially now that they're not even putting out quality products. At least they used to put out things that were good.
Right. Well, they're trying to convince the theater owners that they do have a good upcoming slate. They had Kevin Feige come out, talk about some of the Marvel stuff. Captain America, Brave New World. So they're trying to say that'll be like the new Winter Soldier film, the, you know, Captain America 2. So we'll see how that one goes. They showed some footage. I think we already sort of knew the premise, but, you know, Harrison Ford now stepping into the Thunderbolt Ross character, who's president, and there's going to be a conspiracy to try and take out the president. So our new Captain America.
Harrison Ford is the president and someone's trying to kill him? Sounds like Air Force One.
It sure does. Dude.
Get off my plane.
Imagine they had that scene when they try to get him. He just turns into Red Hulk. That would solve the problem right there. Dunzo. Gary Oldman would be wrecked. Has he been in Marvel?
Who, Gary Oldman?
Yeah.
No.
Wow. This is the time. No better time to bring him back now. But yeah. So we'll see how that goes. That is one of the ones I'm more interested in. But they've been doing a lot of reshoots on it. I think they've essentially shot the film twice now and they're still doing reshoots. So that's concerning. They had Thunderbolts, which don't care. They revealed a logo. It had an asterisk. Feige was playing all coy about like, oh, yeah, you'll see what the asterisk means.
Who gives a fuck? Know.
They're trying to do anything to drum up like interest in that. They did have Deadpool and Wolverine, of course, coming out this year, unlike all the Thunderbolts and Captain America. So the one Marvel film coming out this year, Deadpool and Wolverine, they showed 10 minutes of non-spoiler footage. We've already seen the trailer for that. Again, I am excited for it. I think this will be like the last hoorah of the Marvel stuff.
It'll be fun.
It should be a lot of fun. Inside Out 2, they had that. They showed the first 35 minutes. And it was very well received. Again, we've seen the trailer for that. I'm very confident in that being a big hit, being of the same quality as the first Inside Out. Just because, I mean, like, the story for the sequel was right there of Riley now becoming a teen and having all those new emotions introduced. It's just too good of a premise for them to bungle it. And they've had a lot of time to, you know, work it out. So I think that'll be great. We got Mufasa. So Barry Jenkins came out. He discussed the film, showed a bit of footage. He talked about his history and attachment with The Lion King, where he's seen that original film like over 100 times. So we're in good hands. I think Mufasa, we'll have to see, because they did show footage, but we haven't seen a trailer. I'm guessing they're waiting until the summer movie season. Maybe they put in front of Deadpool and Wolverine, but I'm still waiting on that trailer so that I can be convinced that it'll come out this year. But I think he's cooking there. I think Jenkins is one of the great auteurs of his generation. So I think he's coming to this project similar to the whole Greta Gerwig and Barbie thing. He's going to put his own spin on it and make it worthwhile. And then Moana 2, The Rock came out, having a very busy schedule lately, but he came out for CinemaCon, talked about it, unveiled a few clips, unveiled this big musical number. Again, Lin-Manuel Miranda doesn't seem to be a part of the, like, creating the songs this time around, which is not great, but they did have a musical number, so that'll still be a massive part of Moana. So that's the slate. Are there any of these films that you are excited about above all the others, aside from Mickey 17, which will not be coming out this year, but of the things that we talked about, are there any that stick out to you that you didn't know about before that you're more interested in now?
Probably Trap was the one that I didn't know about that I've learned, you know, today. That seems interesting. All the other ones I pretty much knew. Nosferatu and Twisters, of course, of all these movies, are at the top of the game in terms of something that I'm excited for. So Universal is really crushing it, I guess. I suppose I'm also looking forward to, what's it called, The Killer's Game with Batista. It just seems interesting. And of course, John Wick, Ballerina, if that's supposedly still going to come out this year, although it may get pushed. I think it will be a pleasant watch. You know, it's still a John Wick movie, you know, still exciting.
True.
But definitely Nosferatu and Twisters.
Yeah. Nosferatu. Again, we'll still need to see the trailer for that whenever that drops. But yeah, I agree. Twisters is looking great. I'm excited for the Transformers G.I. Joe crossover. I think that'll be fun. The Last Ronin sounds great. Again, a lot of ones, though, that Disney talked about, for instance, we already knew a lot. I think our excitement level there was already in place. And then Killer's Game, Conclave, those were the new ones that got on my radar from this, for sure. Ultimately, I feel like it was a less hype CinemaCon than, like, last year or years past.
Sure. But
still some good things in here to pick out and to look forward to.
Not a lot of franchises coming out in CinemaCon. I think that's why it's a little less hype, you know. We're in the little transitional period where we have this whole year of 2024 where there's not a lot of big franchise names getting dropped. DC is still taking its time to restart. MCU is taking a break to readjust to whatever it is they're trying to do. Star Wars is fucked. there's definitely like breathing room here. The only thing that's kind of franchise related is just the concept of video game adaptations is starting to take hold, and so we have a lot of those. Mario 2 being name dropped, Borderlands coming out, board games and toy products as well, you know, Monopoly, Transformers, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, things like that. So a lot of that is sort of the carry through, but there's no big franchises getting dropped that we're all really hyped to see right now. It's mostly just people scrambling trying to find something to be excited about. There's no Avatar, there's no Star Wars, like I said. Like, what else is there to be excited about other than these smaller movies like Nosferatu or Trap or Twisters or Sonic, you know?
Right. For sure. So yeah, we will see how the year shakes out. But yeah, some good things to look forward to in there, even though it was ultimately a lighter year at CinemaCon. But let's move on now to our box office breakdown for April 12th to the 14th. Civil War taking first place with 25.5 million. So that is the biggest opening for A24.
Nice.
It is sort of in that range that we thought it would be, of not being like a crazy massive success, but it would be solid enough to get some records for itself, to get the number one spot. So I think it was overall a solid opening for it.
Mm-hmm. Following it was Godzilla Kong, Godzilla X Kong, whatever you want to call it, 15 million.
Ghostbusters, The Frozen Empire with 5.7 million.
Kung Fu Panda 4 with 5.5 million.
Dune Part 2, 4.3 million.
Monkey Man with 4 million.
The First Omen, 3.8 million.
Shrek 2, 1.4 million.
That's right. Shrek 2.
That's for awesome.
Its anniversary release with 1.4 million. That's amazing.
As it should.
That's the other thing, too. Where was Shrek 5 at CinemaCon? What was up with that?
Who knows? Maybe they're not ready to announce anything yet. I mean, it's probably a long way away.
I guess so, but still, give something. The Long Game, which is what they're playing, with 1.3 million.
And Suga, August D Tour, D Day, the movie, 990,000.
What a title. I'm assuming that's like a band. Are you?
I have no idea.
Some boy band. Are you? You're not a fan of Suga?
I have no idea what that is. Okay. I've never heard of that in my life. I'm going to look it up.
Yeah, please do. Let us know what's going on there.
He's a South Korean rapper.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Good for him. I mean,
that's big, though. I thought, yeah normally
that's almost $1 million.
Boy groups, gig up groups, but wow, just a lone rapper out there with the almost hidden 1 mil.
He is the highest grossing concert movie of 2024 so far.
There you go.
Good for him.
Yeah.
Oh, he's from BTS.
Oh, he is?
Yeah.
Did he go solo? Did they break up or what?
I think he just did a solo thing because they're all on their mandatory South Korean military service thing.
Interesting. Well, I guess that makes sense then if he's one of the BTS people. All right. Box office predictions for April 19th. It was
$10 million worldwide in a limited release. That's pretty good.
How much of that is from South Korea?
I have no idea.
Oh, I didn't tell you. I'm sure that, yeah, it takes up a huge part. I'm surprised because I would think America is one of the next biggest markets. Just how big sure K-pop has gotten lately. The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. The new Guy Ritchie film. Henry Cavill 13, in there.
13 million?
13 mil, yeah. I'll say 11 mil.
It's Guy Ritchie. You know, he draws fans, and the trailer probably excited some people, but I don't think it's going to
be a huge
hit.
A lot of films lately. I think I didn't mention the thing, but he had like two that were being shown at CinemaCon. One was called In the Gray. He has this film that just came out. That man is working. It's been like two films every like 1.5 years or something. That's insane.
Good for Guy Ritchie.
Yeah. Getting that money. All right. Now let's talk about Civil War from Alex Garland, starring Kirsten Dunst, Wagner Moura, Kaylee Spaney, Stephen McKinley Henderson, and Jesse Plemons in an uncredited role, which is crazy.
It was so this, uncredited?
Yeah.
That's bizarre.
And then, obviously, this film coming out in an election year, having that title, being from Alex Garland, you knew it was going to be a point of discussion in the heavily discussed films of the year. So let's dive in. We will join the discourse, give our thoughts on it. Mm-hmm. Dylan, you have seen it.
I have.
Have you seen all the other Garland films? Just in general, how you feel about
it? I've only seen Ex Machina. Oh. And I really like Ex Machina.
Okay.
I've not seen any others. I missed out on Men. I wanted to go see that one. I didn't care as much to see Annihilation. And I never watched the show Devs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So that's the only things he's done that I know of. But Ex Machina is fantastic.
Gotcha. Okay. So you're coming into this with pretty much a clean slate then, or the Ex Machina. So what were your initial impressions on Civil War?
I didn't really like it.
Oh, no.
I was not that big a fan. To not get too, if this is just initial impressions, I felt like it didn't take itself as seriously as it could. I didn't think it was trying to solidly make a certain point other than you know, war is bad. Let's not have war. And I don't really care about the characters that much.
All right.
Except for supposedly, I think Kaylee Spaney, I think her character was the only one I cared a little bit about. But other than that, I didn't really care about Wagner Moura. I didn't really care about Stephen McKinley Henderson. I didn't really care about Kirsten Dunst that much. Even though Kirsten Dunst was great in this movie. She gives a great performance, in my opinion.
For sure.
I just didn't really care so much about the characters.
Dang. That's tough. The reason I bring up Alex Garland, because surprisingly I am like very caught up on his filmography. I saw Ex Machina, I've seen Annihilation, and I've seen Men.
Why is that surprising? You're a well-traveled guy. You've seen some things.
Yeah, but it's just one of those weird things where like his complete filmography, I'm just caught up on. Not even like intentionally so of doing it, just that's how it's shaken out in the past couple years.
You just happen to see all his movies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and yeah, Annihilation I saw last fall. Mm-hmm. So, just so, recently.
Since you've seen them all, thoughts on Alex Garland as a filmmaker as a whole?
I think he always comes towards interesting ideas and premises and uses them as a great springboard for discussing amazing topics, like just getting the juices flowing creatively as far as like AI and stuff like that, for Ex Machina, environmentalism, for Annihilation, among many other things in that film. That one is chock full of things. And then Men, I mean, that one's obviously, you know, gender politics and stuff like that.
It's about men, but, you know.
Yeah. So he sort of like has those big ideas and is able to go into them with one, just a very visually stunning approach. I think he is, for someone that like started out in writing and mainly sees himself as a writer, he does have a great handle visually. But then he's one of those films that you always know going into it that there's going to be something worthwhile to think about, going to be intellectually stimulated. There's going to be something there to raise questions and make you walk away from the film, thinking about the film, trying to get at what his perceptions were, what your perceptions are about that topic. So he's a very interesting filmmaker in that sense. However, other than Ex Machina, I've noticed that I appreciate the experience of being like invited into that discussion to like think about those topics more than I feel like I enjoy the actual experience of the film and the way that he lays out his perspective, even though he's one of those filmmakers do that. I mean, they do all his endings sort of do hint at his feelings on something, but they, I feel like he's one of the filmmakers that wants to raise questions more than like preach to you. Mm-hmm. So yeah, and I can appreciate that, but this film fell in line with like Annihilation and Men, where I don't know that it fully clicked. Like I enjoyed the overall conversation around the film and like the provocation of it and people's reactions to how political or apolitical it was than the film itself, which is a shame because I was really, really looking forward to it. But let's start digging into some spoilers. The first off, just the in the trailer, the biggest takeaway was the whole Western forces, the alliance of Texas and California, that got people and their interest peaked because that seems very, based on current real world politics, seemed like a very unlikely thing to occur, to have an alliance between California and Texas. And so we see in this film that the reason that was included in there is this isn't really trying to be commentary on current active American politics.
Yeah.
The setting, which I think is America. It has, you know, things about freedom and all that stuff that's just like fundamentally intertwined with America is raised somewhat in here, but there's never a moment where you get an idea of like what are the sides, who, like what are the political leanings of the sides, stuff like that. He makes it a point not to do that. And ultimately,
I think that works.
I think it was successful. I think it was a smart move to do.
I agree. Because then it's not about which side are you on, what do you agree with? It's about, we are all Americans, good or bad, you know, we should not be fighting in this extreme of a way against one another because we are all of the same cloth, cut of the same cloth.
Mm-hmm. So yeah,
it's commentaries on civil wars as a whole, not just American civil wars, but just the idea of brother fighting brother, you know, what is the point? What is the purpose?
Right. Which I would have actually liked them to dig more into that. Like the idea of brothers fighting brothers and people that, you know, had to live next to each other, go about their days with each other. I mean, your coworkers, your neighbors, all this, and then suddenly being thrust into like out and out conflict with each other. I would have loved to see them dig into that more. They don't really do that other than that one scene, which we'll comment on for sure, the Jesse Plemons thing. But the approach there of just not making it like, okay, we're going to confirm everyone's biases and make the other side that you already don't like coming into the film as the villain so you can feel better about yourself. I think it was great to do that. So you're not alienating people. You're not making it all about, again, just the current politics. You're able to let the story breathe, let the character breathe, focus on, as you said, just the idea of a civil war taking place and the horrors that come from a conflict like that.
Mm-hmm.
So they're also, I've seen people saying like, oh yeah, they don't say what started the civil war or like what made people go against each other. It was pretty clear what started it though. It was the Nick Offerman as the president who goes for a third term and therefore breaks like the Constitution that way, disbands the FBI. So that's what it was. We have someone that was taking over too much power and then certain states secede and then boom, we have our battle lines drawn. That was the start of the conflict. But again, they don't go too into depth of like which political party was Nick Offerman a part of and all that. So yeah, I think that was a good choice. But that's one of the, talking about the overall discourse, that was one of the big issues people had with it, was that they felt like it doesn't have anything to say or it's cowardly for not taking a side. Or
I wish the president had a bigger role in terms of understanding his impact, about how he, the individual man or the individual representation of that man, is the sole responsible for this huge conflict. I wish they had more of an impression on that. I don't mind, like, I'm okay with saying that there's no strict lines drawn as to what party he's a part of or what he did specifically, but just a stronger, clear impression that Nick Offerman, the president, is the like his whole position is the bearer of the responsibility of why these states are seceding. I wish there was a stronger impression of that. Mm-hmm. Just to understand that he is the reason, like to give more of a reason for why they're going so far, just to give an interview of him, you know, what about him is so important that they need to go across all of this treacherous war zones to get there to interview him, other than the fact that he hasn't done an interview in 18 months.
Right. Yep. And then I think overall, the decision to focus on these journalists, just like this group of journalists that are going on a mission to try and get the like last interview or some photos of the president, was a very smart choice. Like centering it around these journalists, I think, again, helps detangle it from, again, just all the politics and the who side on who. You just follow these people that have a clear goal that's sort of outside the motivations of like the war on either side. And yeah, it allows you just to ignore that other part and have them go on a road trip basically through a war-torn United States. And I think the most effective parts of the films are these glimpses that we get of that conflict and how just simple things like going up to a gas station can now become terrifying, or the Winter Wonderland thing, which in itself would be very odd to stumble upon, but then getting caught up in this like sniper shootout. Just those scenes were very tense, very suspenseful.
Yeah.
This man utilized sound design extremely well, because there's a lot of moments of silence that then get broken up with some of the most impactful gunshots in, I don't know, like, when was the last film that had gunshots quite like this. I remember Joker being one of the like ones where it was literally frightening, like spooked out of your seat almost from hearing from
gunshots.
It happened a couple times in this one.
I was thinking of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes is something that had a lot of good warfare and gunshots that were a little bit hard to hit. Yeah. Especially when, what's his name? The evil monkey. God, what is his name?
I don't know.
But he walks up to the guys and he's playing with a gun and pretending to just be a monkey and then he shoots them.
Yes. Yeah. I remember that one.
That one hit hard. Yeah. Koba. Koba.
There you go. So I thought those were actually really effective. And the creme de la creme, the one that definitely I think stands out as the clear, far away best scene of the film, the one with Jesse Plemons.
He's so good.
The one that we saw from the trailer a little bit. Yeah, he is fantastic. Truly, like, edge of your seat type stuff with his just cold, like, psychopathic demeanor that whole time. And
the nonchalance with which he approaches the scene.
Exactly.
He's really, really good.
And then the question, which we heard in the trailer, but yeah, it's done so well in the actual film too, of just what kind of American are you? As he asks every single one of them, essentially saying, like, where'd you come from? And then what we didn't see in the trailer, we see the one, which, yeah, he was a journalist too, but that other guy that had driven up alongside them when they were on the road. And then he's, like, terrified of the situation. And then he asks him, where are you from? He goes, Hong Kong, and then immediately gets shot dead. So a harrowing scene for sure. Definitely the most tense one. And then I think, like, all of that approach, the way he was able to highlight, again, the terror that you would feel just going through these otherwise normal, like, roads, normal events, I thought that was done well. What I would have liked to have seen, which you alluded to before, like, the brother versus brother, and, you know, talking about, like, these journalists, they're obviously war journalists, but seeing them actually engage with some of the citizens and, like, try and get their stories. Like, there's at one point where they go to that refugee camp or something where they're just set up in that stadium, and we just never see them engaging with, like, the real people. We see, like, some of the combatants, and we see a lot of them taking pictures of them, but never really, like, having conversations with them. And then with actual citizens that are just going about their lives or that have been affected by the war or trying to stay out of it, like that one town that was just trying to be all normal, I would have liked to have seen more engagement there just to see, like, how is this affecting everyone in the USA? And again, you have time constraints, it being a movie, but that was one thing that I felt was missing a bit. And I think it would have helped me connect more with the characters, because, like you, I wasn't that attached, even though I could see there were specific scenes that were like, okay, we're going to flesh out the characters here. One was in that refugee camp, like the stadium, where they're on the bleachers. And then Kaylee Spaney, like, asks about Kirsten Dunst's career, how she, like, got into everything. And then there's the moment too, when they're in that normal town and they're trying on the dress. Like, those are the moments that are trying to get us to, you know, align with the characters and start to attach to them. But for whatever reason, it wasn't fully clicking, which is a shame. Even though, again, those, like, tense moments where they're in danger, I was afraid for them and didn't want them to get taken out. But
I really thought Kaylee Spaney was going to die at some point.
You really?
I thought her character was going to get, especially in the end when they're doing the raid on the White House, she's just putting herself out there every single time, walking right into the line of fire. And I'm like, one of these times she's just going to get hit right with a bullet.
Yeah. But again, that was a thing. McKinley Henderson, like, him getting taken out, was coming. Yeah. And then when it actually happened, again, it didn't feel like, I was like, oh no. But it wasn't, like, truly distraught.
Because I like Stephen McKinley Henderson, not because I like the character.
Exactly, yeah. So, and it was also
which is a testament to Stephen McKinley Henderson as a person, as an actor. But
He's a great.
The writing of the character, I don't think, was solid enough for me to care that he as a character died.
Exactly. And it's because they're on this road trip together. You just want more of that, like them feeling like a unit, feeling like a team. And I don't know, that didn't really come across, even though I could see there were specific moments where Garland took the time to allow them room to breathe as characters. For whatever reason, it just didn't click for me. I guess that was the same for you. One thing I wanted to ask you about, of like Garland and his approach to this, why he wanted to, you know, make a film like this and what he was saying with it. What do you think the takeaway is here on journalists?
On journalists specifically, I think the takeaway is that they are important, because the whole time we are watching them photograph, like I do like the bits where they are in the middle of the war zone and they'll take a picture and it'll show the still image of the picture that they took. Mm-hmm. I think that was really impactful. I think it was a smart choice, because I think the whole idea is they are important figures in terms of capturing what is actually going on in a as honest a way as possible. And regardless of which side you're on, you are identifying with the people who are in pain in these photos and the people who are fighting in these photos. And you're identifying with like the emotion in their faces and what's going on because of the pictures that they're taking. But at the same time, I'm also getting the impression that, like, the whole time I'm thinking, why, how could you just stand there and take photos? How could you only just document what's going on? And Dunst has a great line where she says, we're not there to make a change. We're there to document so that others can make a change. It's something like that, like along the lines of that.
Yeah, she was like, because it was in Kaylee Spaney, saw those two people being essentially like hung up by that gas station. And she's like, why didn't I do anything? And Kirsten Dunst was like, oh, don't ask yourself those questions. We take pictures so other people ask questions.
Yes, we that's don't. What it is.
That's what a journalist is. So yeah, they specifically mentioned that part.
I could see the argument, especially because they have the shot at the beginning where it's Kirsten Dunst in a different war zone somewhere else. And the guy's being lit on fire with the tire wrapped around him. And she's just taking a picture of him, is a crazy thing to see, to just have her stand there and not doing anything and just take a picture. But a lot of the times that's what, you know, a journalist is meant to do. They're meant to document horrors and what's happening so that other people can ask questions about why that happened, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think the more focused you are and in the zone to take those pictures, the better and more harrowing those pictures become, and the stronger the questions become, which I can respect as an idea, but I could never do it. Like, I can never be the guy who just takes a picture of something and walks away, as horrifying as it is. Like, I just can't. I can't connect with these characters in that regard, because it's just not something that I believe. And they didn't make me solidly believe that that was a logical and real choice that one can make. I see the argument, but I was not pulled in the direction of their argument even slightly. Like, I did not agree with, especially in the end when Kirsten Dunst, she gets in the way and saves Spaney instead of, you know, documenting, and then she gets killed herself. And I'm like, well, you're not making me, and then Spaney's just taking pictures of her dying. And I just, I don't know. I am not seeing the argument here that this is the right call.
Right. And that's kind of what I would have liked to dig into more, like that idea of, because they directly approach it, as you said, like we do have Kirsten Dunst mention, oh, like these are the questions that we can't raise for ourselves. We have to let other people do it. That is like the most interesting part there, like the ethics of journalism, especially in wartime when there's so much conflict going on and your task is to document, but not to intervene in any way. I wish we would have been able to dig into that more, especially because he already took the burden off of like the actual politics and, you know, arguing one side against the other. He's already removed that. So now hone in on the journalism and make it about like these people that have this terrible duty of taking these photos of awful things, and they clearly are affected by it. They clearly want to do something about it, but they're relegating themselves to only like the documentation and believing that that has to be worth something. I would have liked to have seen, because we never see what becomes of any of those pictures and what impact they're having, like when they're sent back to Reuters or the New York Times or the organizations they're working for. We don't see them like getting posted. We don't see people react to them at all, which can be fine if maybe we had them having conversations about like, is this being effective? Are we moving the needle at all? Are we bringing attention to this in any real way to make it all worth it? She has a great line as well, Kirsten Dunst, where she goes, you know, every time I was off in these other war-torn countries and sending home pictures, I thought I was sending a message back home, don't do this, which is a great line. And that speaks to like, okay, yeah, documenting the conflict to help showcase the horrors of this and try and encourage people to like not let it succumb to this. I would have loved to see more of, again, when we're actually, when the conflict is going on at home, are we able to see how that affects what she's doing? She says a lot of times there are people like her family, Katie Spaney's family, who are just sitting out the conflict. They're clearly not sitting out the conflict, but they're still approaching it as if they are neutral or objective. Again, saying they're not raising questions for themselves, but like they clearly are. They feel some sense of obligation to go out there and try and document this conflict. They're doing it for a reason. They're not just doing it for a paycheck, right? Like there has to be something else there. I would have loved to dig deeper into those motivations, those feelings of like, am what I doing with how, you know, awful it is to like step away from these terrible things that are unfolding before me, not prevent them from happening, just documenting them. Is that making an impact in any way? I just would have loved to dig into those questions more because they're so fascinating. He does bring them up. He like flirts with them a bit, but he doesn't dive into them enough in the way that at least I would have wanted. And again, that's sort of, you know, quarterbacking a film after the fact, saying like, oh, what would I have done? But that's just, that is the version of the film that I know Alex Garland is capable of, because he's done it before with stuff like Ex Machina. I would have just loved to see those, you know, those discussions, those debates play out between these characters. And maybe that would have also helped us attach to them more if we see them wrestling with their job and their profession and what they believe their contribution in this conflict is, to shoot photos rather than shoot guns. I just, yeah, I would have liked to see more of that. You also mentioned like them going after the president and wanting us to see more of like why the president is such an important figure. That also sort of rubbed me a little bit of the wrong way of they're just going after the president. They like say that's their goal in the beginning. It's also been like over a week since I've seen it, so I don't remember that exact conversation when they're saying, oh, we're going to DC. But I didn't get the sense of why they felt that was so important. It did almost feel like, oh, this would be a cool thing to do, or in it, like it would help, you know, be a historic image, rather than it being like, oh, this will help in the war, or this will be essential because we need people to see like what they're fighting against or something like that. It did feel very ego driven in a way of like, oh, I want to do this just because it'll help.
Yeah, like, know, nobody like has interviewed the president, you know.
Yeah, but like, we're no one's done this. We'll be the ones to do this, which again can be interesting, like digging into the selfishness.
I think is what he was trying to do, is the idea of like, they are doing this for the story, for the sake of the story, and no political reasons. And then as the story goes on, as this movie develops and they see more and more of these horrors, which is also a hard line to toe, because these are people who have already seen, you know, war zones. How much more harrowing can this be compared to other war zones? What specifically about this makes it more harrowing? Obviously, the Jesse Plemons incident is more personal and much more threatening to them as individuals, as opposed to some of the other things that they've seen probably. But if Kirsten Dunst and Wagner Moura and Stephen McKinley Henderson are people who have seen these sort of war zones before, what about these ones are making it stand out that now their ego-driven mission has changed into a more political sort of message? Because like the end, Wagner Moura, when he starts, he definitely seems like the kind of character who is ego driven, who wants to do it for the story. But then when you get to the end, he's leaving Kirsten Dunst behind. He's going straight for the president. He's getting that quote because he needs that quote to send a message, like you said, to showcase, to capture that moment, and then capture the moment.
Very true. But yeah, I would have liked us to dig into that more of, again, like them doing it kind of for those selfish reasons, which is fine to investigate. But I feel like that does make these journalists come off in a less good light. And I heard some interviews from Garland where he is talking about like, oh yeah, I wanted to shed light on the importance of journalists and the function that they hold in society and how it's critical. And I don't know that this film necessarily showcases that. It shows that there's a lot of courage and bravery that you need.
I think it shows the importance of photojournalism, but I don't know about specifically journalism as a whole.
But I don't even know if photojournalism, because again, we don't see the impact of those photos. There's also the question too of like in the age of social media and stuff like that, where I'm sure all throughout America, I mean, people are taking these photos. I mean, we've seen that a lot. So that would have been a cool way to engage with it too, of like these photojournalists who are going out there with cameras rather than like their phones, and they're being backed by these organizations, and they're feeling some sort of, I don't know, like professional approach that they have to take as compared to all the other regular citizens who would be documenting things with their phones, and why they still feel like photojournalism in the way that they do it and that has been traditionally done is still necessary. I would have liked for them to tackle that more, because yeah, the photojournalist angle, I don't know if they highlighted the importance of that necessarily, or journalism as a whole. Again, we like touch on these topics, but I don't know, you didn't dive into it in a way that I felt was best, because it does feel like a mixed message. You see Kirsten Dunst die essentially saving Kaylee Spaney, which that, again, I don't know if I fully bought into that, and Dunst like being like, I don't know, having a PTSD episode or something like that, where she was not all together there in the conflict. I don't know why all of a sudden
she couldn't, why there was that role reversal, I don't understand.
Yeah.
Like, so Kaylee Spaney becoming more engrossed in the war zone and being willing to put herself at risk made sense for her character. For sure. But Dunst having like the reaction of not wanting to carry forward and being a little more scared, I just don't know where that came from.
Yeah. So I don't know where that came from, but then she like locks in, but then she ends up sacrificing herself for Spaney, who then is like taking photos of her death. So you see, again, they like both ignore Dunst in the end there, go in and like get the story basically. Again, that doesn't strike me as a very like, oh yeah, these journalists did something here, or it was all worth it in the end, which is fine for him to do. But I don't know, it feels at odds with what I've heard him say in interviews about like journalism and what he wanted to showcase about it. So I don't know. Again, it's interesting to see these topics and see how he tries to engage with them. But this one, more than any of the others, I feel like it slipped through his fingers a bit. At least just in my interpretation of it. And again, it's colored by like, this is an interesting topic. How I would have done it is always going to be different than how anyone else does it. But these are just the things that I would have liked to have seen the thread be pulled on a bit more throughout the film, which he didn't do. And ultimately, that means for me, the film wasn't quite as effective as it could have been. Any other final thoughts on Civil War?
No, I think you touched on it pretty well. That's all I have to say.
All right, then how many photojournalists out of 5 are you giving this one?
2.5.
2.5. Tough, but a fair score. I'm giving it a 3. Again, I do think a lot of those sequences we talked about, the Jesse Plemons ones for sure, above all being the most effective. But they hit, like they do a great job. I just wish, yeah, the characters and the overall thematics would have been on the same level as, you know, that the filmmaking in those scenes. But overall, I think it's a worthwhile film to go and see. I think it does bring about a lot of good discussions. Alex Garland always will be a filmmaker that I have my eye on. But sure, this one, you know, wasn't quite the home run that I was hoping for.
Yeah. But
that's how it is sometimes.
Definitely a little disappointing. Yeah. That's just how it goes. Oh, well, that is all the time we have. If you'd like to give your thoughts on the show, you can email us at theboxofficeshowpod@gmail.com.
Our main title theme for the show is Sundown by Joseph McDade.
If you like the show, please give us 5 stars on whatever podcast app you're listening to, and be sure to tune in next week. Have a great rest of your day.